1414.
Blog Talk Radio.
It's time for Wealth DNA with Ron the Ronald Naraki. It's time to check your wealth DNA so you can enjoy the second half of life. Here's the host of the show, Ron Naraki.
Hello and welcome to the Wealth DNA radio show. And I'm honored that you're joining us today. We'll be talking about investing in our global village. Today is Monday, February 13th, 2012. It's 8 o'clock a.m. in Phoenix, Arizona, 9 o'clock a.m. in Houston, Texas. That's where our guest will be joining us from. For those checking the U.S. equity markets, the markets are off to a good start. We're up about 0.6%. Asia was, well, depends. Japan was up, and that's a market we'll talk a little bit about. And Europe is up today about 0.5% to 1%. So strong day in the equity markets. That's not our focus. Exactly what goes on today. Our key thing is what goes on in the long term. Where to make money. How to make money. Building your wealth. The equity markets have been pretty strong this year. And part of what we'll talk about with our guest is the perspectives for gains in various parts of the world. Not just this year, but in the long term. Our special guest today is Robert Sharar, a well-traveled international investor who can talk about some of the far reaches of the world from his own experience. And when I say far reaches of the world, I mean it. He even invests in Africa. Now, I've heard of emerging markets, but that might be a whole new category. Maybe we'll call them diamonds in the rough, and we'll get his comments on that. On our last show, we revealed the third commandment of investing. Do you remember what that commandment is? It's simply, no risk, no return. Today's topic is a continuation of that theme. Many investors, and maybe even you, have the majority of their investments in their own country. Admit it. Are you country-centric? Why is that investors, and maybe you, focus so much on their own country? That's not the only market in the world. Well, partially, it's familiarity, their comfort zone. And partially, it's due to their perception of other markets being a higher risk. It's probably a fear of the unknown. Do you recall from our last show the definition of investment risk? It's variability. Variability returns from what we expected. Now, many emerging markets have much higher variability and thus higher risk. But some of those markets will zig when your own market zags. Now, investing, we commonly use the term zig and zag as if they were some sort of technical terms, but in essence, what I'm saying is when one market is going up, another may be going down. Or if one market is flat, and the U.S. market's been anything, and most of the equity markets have been anything but that this year, but when one market is flat, another is going up, or maybe it's going down. That's what we mean by zigging and zagging. So rather than adding risk by having investments in several of those markets, your total portfolio actually has less variability and thus less risk than each individual market. So yes, those are risky, variable markets, but put them all together and it smooths out your portfolio. You're tuned to the Wealth DNA radio show. I'm your host, Ron Naraki, and I look forward to you joining us every second and fourth Monday. If you've missed some of the prior shows, like the last one we had on the third commandment of investing, or if you want to re-listen to them, we maintain an archive of shows on www.wealthdna.us. If you'd like to get an email reminder of the shows, you can do one of two things, or of course, do both. send an email to me, ron@wealthdna.us. We'll keep you posted about future shows and events. Or in the upper left-hand corner of the screen, very top of the screen, you're going to see a picture of the Boomer and the Babe. Right below there is a follow button. Just click on there. They'll keep you posted of the great shows on the Boomer and the Babe Network. By the way, if you listen to this show in June and July last year, you might recall that my office burned in the middle of June. Not a fun experience. Well, as of late last week, just 8 months later, eight long months later, we've started the long and tedious process of moving back in, getting things organized. That will take some time. We've gone through 6 temporary moves in those 8 months. You can imagine how much fun that's been. But it's a good feeling to know that I won't have another move in a few weeks or a few months. It is nice to settle in. Now, let me share a little about our guest as we bring him on. The first hat he wears is as president of FCA Corp. That's a fee-only financial planning firm based in Houston, Texas. That's where he's joining us from today. The second is an investment advisor to the Commonwealth Family of Funds. In essence, he's the fund manager of 5 of their funds, and we'll have him give us the details of each of those funds. Let's give a warm radio welcome to Robert Sherrar. Welcome, Robert.
Thank you.
And I'm honored you join us this morning and share some insights on investing in our global village. That's our topic today. And Robert, I shared a little bit about your background in the intro. How do you introduce yourself to an audience?
Well, I'm president of FCA Corp. FCA Corp is an investment advisory firm that's been in business since 1975. I founded the firm. We have approximately 22 employees. I have a little bit different background than a lot of other investment managers. I'm a CPA and I have a graduate degree in business and 2 law degrees, including a tax law degree. So I think our approach to investing would be very value-oriented. We understand financial statements. We like companies that have what I call real products, real financials, and real business opportunities associated with them, which means in many cases that we want to be able to have a good understanding of the financial aspects of the company. That may seem intuitive, but it's not necessarily so for a lot of people.
No, definitely with the CPA background and the legal background, I would assume your due diligence is a little bit more intense than the average person's. By the way, Pete, I don't know if there's anything. We're getting a very scratchy sound from Robert's connection. Are you dialing in from Houston today?
Yes, I am.
Okay, because we're getting a very scratchy voice. I'm assuming that's not your voice today.
Now, do you want me to try to come in again?
Yeah, it may be worthwhile. Let me ask a couple of basic questions, and I'll reintroduce folks to the topic in the show. You wear several hats, so either you're busy and traveling a lot, or you've got some very good assistant managers for each fund. Which is it?
Well, it's really both. I do get to see a lot of the world, and that's one of the things that makes the job so much fun. But we do have a good team of people here that have been involved in the funds for a number of years, and collectively we manage the different funds.
Okay, all right. So you're going to tell us a little bit about the team in a few minutes, but I would suggest, yes, if you could, Robert, is maybe try dialing into that number again, and ideally, and obviously, hopefully you're using a landline because the mobiles will come across and could drop off as well. But yeah, if you could try that, I will reshare with the audience our
topic
and some of the things we're going to cover. And have you rejoin us here in just a minute or so.
I'll call right back in.
All right, appreciate it. Thank you. Yes, today we're talking about investing in our global village. And the world really has become a lot smaller. You know, airfares are down, and as Robert mentioned, he travels an awful lot to faraway countries, far away from Houston, Texas, which is kind of not necessarily the center point of the world, but there is no such thing, right? But where most of the people live, he's a lot closer where he lives than where he travels. And also, import tariffs have come down. So if you go to the various stores, you find more and more foreign goods. Boy, it sure is a lot of foreign goods on the shelves. And I've looked in the U.S. and in Europe, and sure, you know, basically, you see Chinese goods everywhere. We used to see a lot more. Still see a lot of Korean and Japanese, but it's amazing with those tariffs coming down. And how about communication costs? I mean, here we are holding a radio show, and we do this fairly often. Today, the connections aren't ideal so far. But basically, take a look at what's happened with communication costs. I used to pay $1 a minute to dial in from Europe to the U.S., and now we're into the pennies. Okay, Robert, how is the connection now?
Hopefully it's better.
Oh, dramatically better, dramatically better. You're still a little bit on the soft side. I don't know if we can adjust a little bit, but definitely not getting that scratchiness. It was definitely tough to hear. Okay, you are both the president of FCA and fund manager of those funds. Which role, or how do you split your time in? How does that work? I mean, that seems like an awful lot to cover for one person, and even with a good team. So how does your time split between those?
Well, the activities are really, at times, complementary. I do split my time between working with some of our individual financial planning clients and also involved in our overall strategies with regards to financial planning and investing our clients' funds. We do manage separate accounts as well as the mutual funds. But when you travel, as I've been doing for many, many years, you learn a lot about the world that you're a part of, and I think it helps you make decisions not so much in a vacuum. And that's one of the big advantages we have, I think, of our global exposure. We also leverage our contacts. We have developed great relationships with people in the same industry we're in throughout the world, and we share information because it's such a large amount of data out there that no one person has a lock on it. And we found that working together with other people is helpful, and they find the same thing.
So none of us can know everything.
Absolutely.
Fair point. Share a little bit about your career path. Which came first? Because obviously, you know, as you said, you've got a diverse background, the CPA and a legal background, and you're also involved in a number of different associations. But take a look at your career path. Which came first, the direction of financial planning or managing investment funds, which is a difference. I mean, people think about managing individual clients' funds, but there's a difference in running a fund, which is a very concentrated effort. But how did that career plan evolve?
Well, I started on the financial planning side and still am involved in fee-based financial planning.
Sure.
But early on, I was young. I was in my mid-20s, and people were not going to come to us and turn over vast amounts of wealth to manage. So our early clients were people who had cash flow. They may have been physicians or lawyers or small business owners or individuals with modest means who we were working in an environment when I started where tax rates were 70%.
Right.
And everyone thought it was so wonderful they would have been reduced to 50% on your earned income. So planning by putting money aside in retirement plans and doing other types of transactions with real estate and so on generated a lot of ways for people to create wealth. So our early clients were more in the planning aspects and working with the cash flow they had as opposed to large amounts of capital. After a period of time, I guess we were successful at converting our planning into capital, and we began to find situations where we would be asked to help the people actually manage their money. And that evolved, and by the 80s, mid-80s, we were pretty active in that aspect as well. The mutual fund dates back to 1991 when we created our first fund, the Australia-New Zealand Fund. Mm-hmm. But I had been investing in Australia and New Zealand in particular for over 10 years before that. I had family on my mother's side of the family that had moved to New Zealand the turn of last century, and I got a chance to go there, and that's when I sort of fell in love with the country and believed there were some great opportunities. And with that sort of hands-on knowledge, in 1991, we decided to launch our first fund, which was then the New Zealand Fund, which later became the Australia-New Zealand Fund.
Wow. Okay, this is a while back. Now, the Commonwealth family, we're going to introduce each of the funds here in just a second, but the Commonwealth family of funds appears to specialize in what I guess I would say Robert Frost would call the areas of the world less traveled. How do you pick those markets? I mean, you just mentioned the first one was your familiarity back, you know, 20, 30 years ago, you were already investing there. But how do you pick the other areas?
Well, we have five funds. The Global Fund is a fund that really can invest anywhere in the world, and so we would be in developed and undeveloped markets, both in the U.S. as well as externally. So that fund is not so much country-specific.
Sure.
The Real Estate Securities Fund was a fund we established to be able to invest globally in real estate-related assets, and we defined it broader than bricks and mortar. We didn't want to be just another REIT fund, so we wanted to have the ability to invest in companies that would be impacted by the real estate industry. So that could be a title company, for example. It could be a building supply company. We just felt there were more opportunities, and we were better served on a global basis to not be tied to just bricks and mortar. While we buy real estate companies that would be REITs, overseas, a lot of companies don't operate under a REIT structure, which, you, as you may know, is just a sort of a U.S. creature of tax law.
And so, therefore,
we wanted to have a broader mandate than just what we know as REITs. Our Japan fund focuses only on Japan. We've been involved in that fund. It was run by another large Japanese brokerage firm through the mid-90s. They sort of gave up on it, I think, at that stage. Japan's market had been beaten up pretty bad, and we took that fund over because we thought it gave us an exposure to the Asian markets. And while that's been a long road, even to today, you know, Japan has still struggled with figuring out what it's going to be when it grows up. We still feel there are opportunities, and we've tended to focus on companies there that we think can do well even in that type of environment. And our latest launch is our Africa Fund. We've been involved in Africa since 1992 in terms of on-the-ground involvement in companies there, not through a mutual fund, but direct investment where we had active roles in the companies, and particularly in the insurance and banking industry. And based on that, we had the opportunity to do business in about nine different countries in Africa, and realized that the continent was going through major changes. And while you can every day read about all the bad things, you could also go there and experience the emerging middle class, the impact it's having on governance in a lot of countries, the great demand for goods and services. And our focus is not on the extraction industries. I mean, I think there's lots of ways that people can decide that. But we've tried to buy and are going to continue to buy companies beyond just those that are in the resource area, because we think there's a lot of opportunities in that marketplace.
Okay. Now, most of our listeners have access to the Internet during the show. Let's share the actual names, the full names, and the symbols. So if somebody wants to do a little bit of looking and dollar amount and how they're doing and whatever. The first, as you mentioned, was the Commonwealth Australia New Zealand Fund, right? And what's the symbol on that one?
Well, maybe before we do that, we have a pretty robust website.
Called
CommonwealthFunds.com, and each of the funds is featured on there. The prospectus is available, and the historic reports and other information. And so I think people would find by going to the CommonwealthFunds.com website, they would be able to obtain good information on all the funds.
Correct, and that's Commonwealth Funds, S at the end, folks.
Yes, that's right, CommonwealthFunds.com. One of the things we've done, and I think on our Africa Fund this is really a great example, is we decided that one of the issues associated with investing in Africa was understanding Africa. So if you look at our website, what we've done is we have an interactive map. The map takes you to information on each country in Africa. We've linked it to the CIA fact sheet, which is a very good resource on each country. We have also put up the links to every stock exchange in Africa. So if people want to look on their own beyond what we're doing, they can look at the different stock exchanges. I think a lot of people don't realize how many functioning stock exchanges there are. And the fact that South Africa, which is certainly the largest and most established market, But it's not the only stock exchange, and they're in all shapes and sizes. I remember going to the Zimbabwe Stock Exchange back in the mid-90s, and we went in a room. They had literally blackboards on each side. Everybody sat around. They wrote up on the board who wanted to sell and who wanted to buy. They conducted their transaction and said, come back and see us after lunch, and we'll show you how we close the market for the day. So
wow.
It was a far cry from you know, what we would be knowing here in terms of the electronic exchanges and things.
Sure.
You find all types of things going on across Africa now, and the regional stock exchanges and groups. So what we've also done is put links to other sources that we think people would find of help in terms of understanding Africa. And this was based on, you know, over a decade of experience there. So we have links to the State Department sites, the different communities that have evolved in Africa. The regionalization, for example, the Eastern Africa community, the SADC region, which is Southern Africa, the Eastern Western Africa, particularly the French-speaking countries. So we've put links to all these different resources because I think they're important for people to understand, and we find it helpful.
Wow. Now, as I recall, each of your funds invests in both equities and fixed income, correct? So it's not you're limited just to equities, correct?
Yes, and that's very important, particularly with international funds, because the yields in many of these markets will be much higher at times than the U.S. might be.
Mm-hmm.
And we have found it advantageous to be able to own fixed income in the portfolios. It'll vary as to how much we have, but it's a way for us, for example, if we feel like we like a particular currency, we may use their fixed income as a vehicle to hold that currency, getting a return as well as whatever currency appreciation we expect to get out of that particular currency. So we prefer that than to using futures or things of that nature.
So now, you put it mildly in saying that other markets may have better interest rates or better yields. I guess I can't think of any place but the U.S. or Japan that are as low as they are. It would be hard to be much lower.
well, that's true. For example, in New Zealand, the 90-day bank rates, our forecast are that it's going to be in the 4% range this year. Their 10-year government stock would be over 5%. So now these also carry with them currency risk.
Absolutely. Good disclosure. Thank you.
And you could win or lose based on that. You know, one thing I think would be interesting for your listeners is we are, for example, in Australia and New Zealand, about the only game in town for people who want really a mutual fund that invests in that region. So one of the things we've tried to do, though, is to not just mirror what people could do on their own. And so you can buy ADR shares. And I think for some people building their international portfolio, there's nothing wrong with buying directly stock in a company they like. That's certainly possible for people with the larger companies to do that. That's why you'll see our portfolios often focus on smaller mid-sized companies, which we think people are not going to be able to buy on their own. Doesn't mean we don't buy ADRs or some of the bigger companies, but we tend to try to add a component to the portfolio that would not duplicate what an active U.S. investor is doing who's buying the ADR shares. The other option is exchange-traded funds. In fact, there's so many mutual funds and even exchange-traded funds out there that it's hard to keep up with them. But having said that, in virtually every market we're in now, you can buy an exchange-traded fund. But if you were to buy, for example, the Australian exchange-traded fund, what you would end up getting is a very, very heavy dose of banks and resource companies, much more so than you would find we might weight our portfolio. So the disadvantage with the exchange-traded funds is that they tend to focus on the larger companies. They're often market cap-weighted, and they often end up with very, very heavy sector concentrations. So there again, there's nothing wrong with them, but they have their benefits and their limitations to the user. But there are many, many ways for a U.S. investor to invest overseas. The other comment I'd make is that from a tax perspective, in most cases, particularly with the mutual fund, we account for all the tax consequences, and people get a 1099. And one thing that might be of interest is that in many markets, for example, in New Zealand, we get our dividend topped up. If we file the proper forms with the New Zealand authorities, because they have a more efficient tax system than we do and they don't double tax the dividends, we actually get an additional dividend for the tax imposition that a New Zealand resident would get as a credit. So they top up our dividends. So when in some of these countries, when you see the gross dividend, they're actually paying you back the tax, if you will, as a foreign investor. And if they do have a withholding, you get a credit for that on the U.S. tax return.
Wow, did not know that. Okay, let me remind our radio audience, you're listening to the Wealth DNA radio show. I'm your host, Ron Naraki. Look forward to you joining us every second and fourth Monday. Our special guest today is Robert Sherrar. We're talking about investing in our global village. Now, I'd also like to remind you that during the radio show, we welcome you, our listeners, that is, to ask questions. Either start a chat in the area below the radio player or call in, and that number is 917-388-4162. I'll repeat that, 917-388-4162. Okay, Robert, let me spend, the one that's clearly intriguing is the Africa Fund. That is your newest one, as I recall you mentioned. When was that actually launched, and is there any competition in that market as far as mutual funds to invest there?
We launched the fund November 1. I believe there's another small Africa fund with a little different focus than ours. But outside the ADRs and the exchange-traded indexes, I don't think there's much else available to my knowledge.
By the way, I forgot to interject. ADR, just to define, make sure all of our audience is on the same page, American Depository Receipts. Basically, that foreign security is traded either one for one, or could be even two for one, or one for two on the American exchange, so that the dollar amount is available. So actually traded here in the U.S. And then they have the opposite of American funds or American stocks are traded in foreign markets on GDRs. So anyway, just wanted to make sure we define that for folks in case they didn't catch that term. Robert, in entrepreneurship or in innovation, we talk about being in the leading edge. But is an investment fund in Africa almost on the bleeding edge?
Well, I could understand how you could make that comment, because we certainly see all the strife and the terrible things that happen.
Correct.
But several years ago, I was asked to speak at a conference on Africa. And one of the points at the time was I sort of queried the audience why they were surprised that so many of them had lost money on their Russian investments. Everybody said, well, how does that relate to this?
Right.
Africa can be very risky. But remember, the markets, there's no Sudan Stock Exchange. it's all sort of relevant here in terms of the countries you're going to be in. Now, I'm not suggesting there's not strife in some of the countries that do have exchanges.
Sure.
But those tend to not function that actively anyway. The reason I use the Russian comparison is that Africa, particularly in those countries that were influenced by the English colonization, have a great understanding of the legal systems. When we made our first investment in Malawi back in the mid-90s, one of the things that impressed me was that Deloitte and KPMG had both had offices there, I think, for over 30 years.
Wow,
when I went looking
long,
for accounting information, I had no trouble finding people that spoke the same language. When we saw our first set of documents, except for a few things that the British would use in their legal system that had been adopted locally, the corporate articles and other things looked a lot like what we would have here. So that's relatively easy to understand, and you will find that most of the most functioning exchanges are in countries that would have that background. Now, there are exchanges in the French West African area, obviously, but basically they function much like you and I would understand them. The other thing is that Africa really is going through a major change, and particularly in Southern Africa. And parts of Eastern Africa, too. The middle-class community is growing very rapidly. Education is becoming more available. And people want the same kind of things that any other emerging middle class wants, goods and services, you know, better life, financial services. And in many respects, I've seen things in Africa. The first time I ever saw a flip phone that had a typing keyboard on it, like I have my BlackBerry now, but it was in the middle of Africa. I said, what is that? This guy next to me. And here he was using a cell phone with a flip, you know, keyboard on it. Banking by internet over the phone, over the cell phone banking kinds of things. So you see in some respects they're not burdened by the infrastructure issues because they don't have the infrastructure in some countries. So they're just going to the next technology there. What we're finding is that in some respects I think Africa's gold is a little bit like a European Union without the currency issues. You know, they've been very, I wondered early on, you know, from when I first started going, well, why doesn't the Southern Africa region all just adopt the rand? You know, it seemed to be the biggest country. You know, why all these other countries, currencies? They've recognized that all these countries aren't economically equal. They need to interact, so they're doing things like working on infrastructure projects, you know, regional power, better roads, some governance issues, but not trying to get ahead of themselves on the currency issue, which I think is really a good strategy. And you're seeing that in the East African community, the countries there, such as Kenya in that area. You've got 15 countries in the SADC region, which is the Southern Africa Development Community, working together on infrastructure, regional power grids, regional manufacturing supply chains. And I think that's going to have a great result. And there's a tremendous demand. I said we've been there for almost 20 years. One experience we had, we actually lease buildings that I guess you could say Walmart is our tenant. Now, this is not in our mutual fund, but we had a real estate project that built two shopping centers. Those centers put in a store that it turns out is owned by Massmart, which is the company Walmart's involved in South Africa. So I guess back door we own Walmart leased property. The point is that when these centers were built, the view was they would never work. You know, they were done nicely. People said there wasn't money in the economy. If you go into the supermarket, which is ShopRite Checker out of South Africa, in this other country, they're running these supermarkets, you would think you're in an American supermarket. You know, it's modern. There's the misters over the fresh fruit. There's a deli bar. But the consumer there, because once they started being able to buy quality, you know, food that wasn't out of date stamp on the cans, et cetera.
Right.
There's a lot more money in that economy than anyone ever realized. And they've both been very successful in terms of not only their own operations, but forcing the standards of other competitors in the market to step up to the plate, too. So we see a tremendous opportunity for companies to do business, particularly throughout Southern Africa and some parts of West Africa, too, on a regional basis. Insurance, banking, all those types of services are in huge demand, whether it be casualty or life insurance or retirement types of things. The formal sectors in Africa are in growing very rapidly and need all the kinds of things that any other developed market needs.
Boy, as you share some of that, it kind of reminds me of the time I spent in the mid-90s in Eastern Europe. I mean, a lot of the things that you're talking about that are there, but on the other hand, the, you know, leapfrog some of the technology. You're not going to go try to put landlines in place. Why not just move right to cell phones? And why would you do telegraph if you can do internet? And on and on and on. Just mention a couple of the countries. Not all of us have a chance at the moment to check on the internet. Some of the countries you're investing in. I mean, I think of, as you mentioned, South Africa is kind of the biggest market there. And I think of the other one, which many wouldn't even consider, I assume, as part of your geography, since it's part of the Middle East, would be Israel. Would be another that would fit in. Do you fit Israel and those countries in there? And talk about a few of the others.
Our definition of Africa is continental. Okay, so there is another closed-in fund that goes all the way up through that region. We don't. You mentioned the Johannesburg Stock Exchange. You have an exchange that's been in business, I think about 150 years. There's a lot of information on the exchange website itself that people can look at. But that's one of the things that we've looked at. You can buy companies traded in South Africa, so you have liquidity. You have relatively good governance. In fact, in some respects, the South African companies are subject to more governance issues than the American companies are, which is hard to believe that anybody.
Yeah, I was going to say very hard to believe. Yes, exactly.
But they're big time into some of those programs, and so what you have is companies that are expanding their product line. You know, ShopRite Checker is a good example of that. I mean, that's a stock we own in our portfolio, and they are expanding throughout the continent, providing their supermarkets. You know, those type of services. You find the same thing in the banking groups. You find it in the insurance groups, transport companies that are regional on the transportation side. You may get a kick out of this, but, you know, SAB Miller, which is South African Breweries, is actually a global company. Now, they have a tremendous link to the Southern Africa region because of the South African brewery history, but they're all over in all kinds of products throughout the region. So we think things like transport companies, companies that supply goods and services to the middle-class community, tourism, all those things. Now, if you go on the regional exchanges themselves, you can find stocks that you can buy that are not involved with South Africa. You would tend to, you know, for example, in exchanges like Kenya would be a good example, but you have Tanzania, Malawi, Zimbabwe, Zambia, the whole region there have some companies that are fairly attractive companies. Sometimes they'll have an affiliate in South Africa. For example, in the Malawi Stock Exchange, there's a sugar company listed, but its parent is also a South African company. So at times you would end up with something that's linked to another company. Other times they're standalone operations, and those have some very unique characteristics and opportunities for growth in those markets you would not get elsewhere.
Yeah, no, I agree. And having spent some time in the international markets, you really do get a different perspective, and that's why really enjoy having you on this show. Now, from my perspective, I wouldn't consider investing in Africa or New Zealand other than through a fund. I mean, I don't know the accounting standards. I don't know the companies operating there. I don't know the local markets. I don't know what the valuations are in those markets. Do you see many foreigners investing directly in those markets other than through funds?
Through ADRs, you'll find that, but that's a pretty limited.
But that's universe. The big companies.
Yes. And so the answer beyond that is no, for several reasons. First off, our government has seen fit to put a lot of burdens on foreign investing. And
right.
So
that's
to deal with the extreme situations, if you invest and open an account overseas, you have to attach forms to your tax return now.
That's correct.
You have special filing. So if you're talking about a typical investor who's not putting a huge amount of money, the paperwork can be overwhelming to be able to establish an account. Every time you need the currency, you've got to almost go down to the airport and pay big exchange rates to move your dollars to whatever currency you want. So it's really not that easy for American investors to get into most of these markets on a direct basis. The other thing, if you want to trade in New Zealand, you got to be prepared to trade Sunday night. Remember, they're open Sunday
correct.
Night.
Correct. Very different hours. Yep.
Our Japan thing. I mean, it's the middle of the night, and we're not 24/7 every day of the week, but many times when certain things are happening, one of us will be staying
change
up very
hours,
late
sure.
or getting up very early so we can participate in a call or be on top of something that we think is happening in that marketplace. And so you have to, that's not practical for someone either to do that. And then it's knowing the local markets. I mentioned my accounting background. I've been teaching classes to the Attorney CPA Association for years on international financial reporting standards. And while they have a lot of similarities to U.S. accounting, they're not the same. I mean, one of the first things I learned, much to my chagrin, over 20 years ago was that they will allow you to write up assets. So if you look at a financial statement, we're used to looking at book value. Well, what if
correct.
I tell you the book value is made up of estimates? You know, people have revalued the assets. And those guesses may or may not be wrong. And at one point, they ran that through the income statement. So imagine that you could take an appraisal every year and talk about profits. So while there's a convergence of international financial reporting standards to make them somewhat consistent, each country adopts their own standards, and they may have their own idiosyncrasies. And so you have to expend some effort to understand the financial statement. And we do that several ways. You know, one is because I'm literate in those types of things. But second, we reach out to people in the local market that people that practice here all the time know where the catches are. And we say, look, you know, what are the things in your standards that are a little unusual? Will you share that with me? And, and we even send our people to attend accounting courses. And we were told by the New Zealand we interviewed the people in New Zealand who converted the U.S. government to a GAAP financial statement for the government. Imagine the U.S. reporting his finances on a GAAP basis. But he told us we were the first tourist that ever asked to come visit him about his changing the accounting standards. But you learn a tremendous amount from those kind of interactions with other people.
Correct. And having been involved in a multinational corporation in those markets, you do have to do both sets of accounting, both for local and for the U.S. market, and that is fairly tedious. So, yeah, some of those things are burdensome. Now, is that one of the factors I mentioned right at the beginning of the show that many investors invest too high a portion of their portfolio in their local market? Is that one of those factors, that unknown, the fear, or is it just they don't hear about those investments, they don't hear about those funds? I mean, what are some of your points you would make for people that do focus on just their own market? Let's say they're U.S. based and therefore they invest, you know, 90% of their assets in the U.S. What would be some of your comments to them?
Well, first, as you're well aware, the person who invests in the U.S. may have an international component because so many companies are global. And so you are going to have some international business aspects. But that's different than having the pure play of a foreign holding. They're not the same. You know, the fact that a company does business in other parts of the world doesn't get you the same play here that investing in a company overseas does. And I think that the U.S. market is a relatively small portion of the global market today. And you really avoid global investments at your own peril. Diversity in all aspects, I believe, is important. And because of that, you have to invest in every asset class. And at times, you know, people, I think, always think they're going to invest in only the ones that are going up. I'm not that smart. But what I've found is that by diversity, you tend to smooth out and pick up returns that you would not otherwise get. And I think global investing affords you several aspects. Local economies do not walk in step with the U.S. If you're investing in a small agricultural company in New Zealand or a port in New Zealand, its activities may not reflect totally the global marketplace. And certainly on a short-term basis, the sentiments for that stock, just like in the U.S., you know, we own some stocks and companies in the U.S. that are really local companies, you know, local utilities, things of that nature. The price of those stocks depend more on what the local community thinks of that company than the big market, and they don't tend to go in lockstep with the other market. The other thing you would enjoy investing overseas is you get a higher dividend yield. You know, you're looking at gross dividends projected to be in the 7-8% range, for example, in New Zealand. Most foreign companies believe that they should set a dividend policy that sets forth, in fact, many times they're mandated to set a policy as to how they're going to distribute the profits. So unlike the U.S., where so often management keeps the money supposedly because they're smarter than you as the investor, these foreign companies tend to be forced to pay out returns. And because the fixed income are higher, they have to pay out higher returns to attract investors. And I think that gives you a nice steady stream. And I think the fact you're getting those on a converted basis, you're getting a constant dollar average of your currency because, you know, you're converting these dividends at different points in the year into dollars, and thereby, you know, hopefully benefiting from that over time.
Correct, to steady your stream.
Yeah. So I think global investing is important. I think funds play an important role in that. You know, it's costly to invest overseas, and you know, and I think there is some size benefit of, you know, in terms of lowering the cost structure, but for an individual, you were talking about the dollar phone call. When I'm in Africa, unless I'm on Skype or something, it's $3 a minute.
Yeah, okay, even worse.
Doesn't sound like a lot, but you know, if you're on the wrong phone line, it could be extremely expensive.
And the quality of the lines are still not quite the same, so you do spend a little more time going checking if somebody's still on the line. Yeah, no, I agree. No, it really is a disincentive to make those phone calls. That is really high. You know, you just reminded me of something. I'm surprised you didn't mention this, and it is something that I guess it was an analysis. Don't ask me which major investment company did it, but every once in a while they'll update their table of the best equity markets around the world. And I think they're like at the time of the analysis, like 108 equity markets. And the question I would ask then people from that analysis is, okay, if you look over the last 100 quarters, I think they did it quarter by quarter, and you know both annual returns and stuff like that. So if you looked at the last 25 years and you know individual quarters, how often, let's say, the U.S. market or the German market or any one of those markets was the number one market, in the world, and the answer is generally zero. It's, you know, the best quarter, best year at any point in time is a market that we just weren't invested in. It could have been Israel, it could have been Russia, it could have been anywhere around the world, and it's very seldom one of the countries that's developed and everybody invests in.
Well, and I think maybe to reinforce that, I guess in 2011, the U.S. was probably one of the best performing major markets, earning nothing.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a flight to safety.
Correct.
Not in my mind, not because the U.S. was so safe, but really to what people thought their other options were, U.S. was safe.
Correct, and the market return was zero.
Yeah, and so...
so that's pretty scary, but a lot of it was currency related.
Yeah, that's right. And so I think that, look, it's not what I found is not necessarily to be the winner every year. What you want is somebody that could, you know, over time finishes in the top part of the game.
Sure.
But it's more of a marathon than a sprint for most investors, and I think you need to look at it that way today. But you're right that I think you invest only in the U.S. at your own peril today.
Correct.
Right now, Europe's mess has given us a breather here better, more than we deserve otherwise. You know, but for Europe's financial difficulties,
right,
the focus would be back on us, but all those funds that might have gone to Europe as a safe haven have abandoned it, and there's not a lot of other places for them to go with the dollars, and so therefore we're getting the benefit of that in a lot of different ways. But that's only temporary.
Yeah, the Bill Gross had a great expression recently. He said the U.S. Is kind of like the cleanest shirt in the hamper. Everybody's dirty, but the U.S. happens to come out pretty well compared to the others, but that doesn't mean it's a good market. Let's just talk a little bit about some of the markets you invest in. Let's talk about Australia and New Zealand. What are their perspectives there? I mean, obviously they've done very well. Even the Aussie dollar has... done very well in the past months. What, you know, when you look at that market, how does their performance look over the next 10 years, let's say, versus some of the developed markets like U.S. or Europe?
Well, I think that Australia and New Zealand are different markets. You know, New Zealand is a very small market, but what's going to drive it is that it can export water, virtual water.
Hmm.
If you look, there's an aluminum smelter facility on the South Island. It exists because they're able to produce hydro power to run that.
Gotcha.
Their export of food products exists because New Zealand has such a large amount of natural rainfall to grow grass, and therefore they can export that. I call it virtual water.
Right, and good expression.
So the New Zealand story is that it is a breadbasket far bigger than its size. That will continue. It has some other goods and services that it can export into the Asian region effectively, tourism, education, things of that nature. And so New Zealand, those will support the growth of New Zealand, and the economy is in relatively good shape, and their debt to GDP and things like that are just not out of control. Australia is a whole different story. You know, Australia mm-hmm. has the natural resources the world needs.
Right.
Their problem right now is their growth is so strong that I think people are concerned that it will overshadow and wipe out other business units in Australia. There's such demand going into building these facilities, and the resources or the need to do that in terms of labor and other costs are driving up costs, which makes some
businesses
less competitive, and the strong Australian dollar. But I think that's a good problem to have. They're dealing with it as a country. They're trying to clamp down on some of the growth to be sure it just doesn't get totally ahead of itself. They don't have a lot of debt in place as a country. Their immigration policy, I think, is rational, but allows meeting some of this demand. If Japan is going to get rid of their nuclear facilities, they need all that gas out of Australia to run their country. You know, the LPNG facilities and those things. I mean, huge investments going into those, huge. And they're building whole new ports, rail systems, everything. So Australia, unless you believe the world's going to quit using these kind of resources, whether it be iron ore or gas or whatever, Australia's got a good near-term future ahead of it. And I hope America's smart enough to keep the strong relationship it's always had with Australia, because I think they're a great global partner to be involved with. So those two markets, I think, have from an investment perspective, are very attractive on a long term basis, absolutely, and even on a shorter term basis, they should do reasonably well. We obviously think the African continent is ripe for growth and expansion that'll translate into investment opportunities. You know, Asia, Japan, for example. I'm on my way to Japan and Hong Kong and India shortly, just to sort of be on the ground there again and get a better feel for what is happening by meeting with other people. And the Japan story is really not so much Japan, but whether they can take all the financial wherewithal they have, the business operations, and successfully operate other businesses in Asia. And Japan seems to be focusing on that in a big way now.
Okay.
And I think is in a good position to benefit from the Asian growth. You know, China, we're not a big direct investor in China. I still think I'm not saying not to trade with China or to invest with
China. Right. But as an investment, bit of a lottery.
But remember, I don't know the date for sure, but I will bet there was not a school of public accounting in China worth a darn 15 years ago, if even today. So where are they getting all these accountants that are supposedly doing the financial statements? And you know, governance, I mean, don't they report their GDP numbers quicker than anybody else in the world or something?
Right. But where do they come from? Sure.
Yeah, where do they come from? So I'm not saying that China's not a big part of the future growth of the world. It certainly is. But I think you could do better dealing with companies that deal with China as opposed to just dealing with companies within China. I still think there's going to be some surprises there.
Okay. So you think Japan may actually start moving to kind of positive territory after such a long lag? I mean, yeah, some great, as you said, they run businesses well. They've got the quality. They've got the team spirit. The people are very dedicated and hardworking, and yet the economy has really been in the doldrums. I mean, do you see that pulling out over the next number of years?
I would hope so. I mean, they're strapped with a rapidly aging population. Remember that people in Japan have been used to getting no returns on their investments for a long time. You know, the postal bank can't seem to wean off taking in all the dollars. I mean, the government has huge amounts of obligations ahead of them. One of the reasons on my trip, and one of the things I'm hoping to try to get a better handle on, is where is it in that process? And I'm meeting with several people from different walks of life that have established relationships over the years to get their take on what they think is really happening with the culture and with people's acceptance. I mean, Japan has to figure out how to get some younger employees in Japan itself, how to deal with the aging population issues, the support they need. You know, they're a first-rate country. They do things right in many respects. And, can they translate these things into further growth? I've seen some very interesting things. I mean, one of the Japanese companies recently bought a Brazilian company. I mean, you're seeing the. If you talk when I talk to the Japanese companies that come by to see us, they're thinking globally and even beyond Asia, and I think that's very, very interesting in terms of their strategy there.
Okay, so that may be that it's just not a Japan play anymore. Eventually, Japan becomes more of that global player, as you were alluding to.
We're trying to look to the company. We look in companies in Japan that, for example, handle the export channels or import channels that benefit from the flow of goods. We're looking for companies that have offshore views and ability to execute those, whether it be in healthcare products or manufacturing or other types of activities. So those are some of the types of things that we would look for in companies that are based in Japan that we think could give them a better growth rate and better returns than maybe just a regular investment in Japan might do.
Correct, as opposed to the index, if you will.
You know, Latin America.
Okay, I'm sorry.
I think real estate offers a lot of opportunities, and people are short-sighted to not understand. You know, that real estate is the one thing that it's truly limited supply, and if you have the right location and the right kind of products. Time will be your ally there. I mean, I'm very fearful of an inflationary economy here. I don't care what the Fed says
right.
in terms of all this. I mean, everybody's trying to convince us so much not to worry about it that I'm suspect of their abilities to really contain everything. And I'm sensing when I talk to people, I don't know what you see, but 2012 seems to be a new start. I mean, I think people really, it's kind of funny. I mean, I think people really close the book at the end of last year. You hear this, oh, it's a new year. What I'm detecting
right.
is a little bit more optimism, but that's across the board. I mean, people are saying, look, I haven't had a raise in a while. I want to make more money. They're seeing their gas bills go up. They're seeing all these other things go up. And I think there's this cooked-up demand in place here that's going to put us in an inflationary environment, and certainly
correct.
Real estate is retracted quite a bit. And so as one of the asset classes, I think it deserves looking at.
Jack, no, I agree. And by the way, in terms of full disclosure, most of the audience would know, I manage a real estate fund, a residential real estate fund here in the Arizona market. So that is an area near and dear to my heart, although, as you mentioned earlier, yours is a global focus. You're looking at real estate not just of buildings in an individual's geography or a certain type. You're looking at global opportunity in anything real estate related. So a very different, let me call it a twist, a different angle on the on investing in real estate.
Yeah, and it really, I mean, you know, that's what we're trying to do because I think there's a lot of components to it. And in some parts of the world, you can't really do what we do here in terms
correct.
Of real estate. So that's not available in the same sense. But, yeah, it's absolutely an investment class that people should do. And it's amazing. I mean, it's not amazing. People tend to react to the news of the day. And that's, I guess, human nature. And then you have contrarians. But the hard part is to be somewhere in between the contrarian and a reactionary. Yeah, the answer
right.
is always not to do the opposite. But it's clearly something
correct.
In between that.
All general rules are false.
Yeah, that's right.
We've got only a couple minutes left here. Let's talk about if you looked at your own personal portfolio rather than the portfolio of those funds. You then decide how you spend, you know, you allocate your portfolio among your own funds and other investments possibly. But what markets are you most heavily weighted in? Which ones are you personally most optimistic about?
Well, you know, for my own basis, I sort of dance with the one that brung me, and so you know my investments tend to be through our funds
mm-hmm.
To avoid conflicts on that.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
You know, but how you know from a you know sort of a view, I have fixed income. I think right now the tough thing with fixed income is you have to accept low returns to avoid getting whipsawed on the back end.
Mm-hmm.
So to the extent I believe you need to have fixed income for opportunity, you need to keep that fairly short term now because you're not going to get paid a lot for taking the longer term risk, and I think that'll come back to haunt people. So we do believe in a fixed income allocation, but it's painful right now for that allocation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think that I'm fairly global in terms of my view of where funds should be. But global implies there is some U.S. investment in
mm-hmm.
play.
Sure.
And I still like, you know, fundamental kinds of things about companies. The fact that nobody else recognizes doesn't mean you're wrong, or the fact they do doesn't mean
correct.
You're right either. You know, and so at times it takes a while to catch up, and one of the things I've learned is if you're too smart, no one else will ever figure it out.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to sort of figure out what are important things about a business that people in general look at over time and
right.
try to
and
buy
latch on to.
Yes.
Okay. What are some of those opportunities today? Which of those markets do you think are undervalued? Is it you know, the Africas and the New Zealands, because people haven't caught on yet, or are there others that you would mention that you know are likely to be strong performers?
Well, I think that there could be some interesting opportunities in some parts of Europe. You know, one area that, you know, particularly maybe you know, some of the Eastern European countries, even Spain, with all its turmoil, because so many of the companies listed in Spain actually do business in Latin America. If you look at their component of revenues, often their 30, 40, 50% of their activities are actually in Latin America. And I don't know if you've noticed, but it seems like Latin America has just gone quiet on us.
Yes.
You don't hear about it. Right. Brazil is cooling off a little bit. But I think that there again, I mean, it's sort of out of focus and out of favor right now, and it's probably worth looking. And we have been taking a closer look at some of the companies and that are listed in the Latin American stock markets, because we think there are some opportunities. And real estate actually may be an interesting play in Latin America.
Because, a lot of people there.
And also because maybe those assets will be somewhat inflation-proofed if things continue to kick up there, that's, you know, particularly somewhere like Argentina.
Correct.
That's probably a good strategy to do. But I think Latin America is worth looking at also.
Okay.
And the other,
which markets
the other
are you? I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
I was just going to ask about how about underweighting. Which ones are you less optimistic about? Which ones are you putting less money into, or maybe even avoiding?
Well, I think mainstay Europe right now.
Okay.
I don't think it's over there. They've got to go through a whole change in psychic. You know, as much pressure as we have in the U.S. to decide who can live off the government, Europe's that on steroids. You know, their working class has been pushed to pay things which sound good on the back end but are terribly costly to deliver. And they, too, have an aging population issue. And immigration is not an easy issue for Europe. And so I think that some of the more developed economies there are going to continue to struggle for a while. And probably staying on the sidelines is not a bad strategy with regard to a lot of European things.
Okay.
But within any of these contexts, I think there's always exceptions, obviously. So I would never be totally out of any market.
Right.
But India is the other play that's somewhat out of favor now, and I'm really curious to see the psychic when I go there as to whether that's likely to turn here. It was the darling, and now it too seems to be slowing down quite a bit.
Okay. You also mentioned China as one that you don't focus heavily on, and I would tend to side with you there. Are there any markets you're shorting?
We don't really we don't execute shorts. I mean, we would at times do in the money calls. That's probably as close as we'd come to a short, if you will, on something.
Sure.
I mean, our structure is not to do those type of transactions, or we would avoid a market.
All right. Let me ask one more unfair question. How are the global equities going to perform in 2012? Who are they going to be the winners, and will it be an up year or down year overall for the world?
Well, I think it will be up this year. You know, whether a lot of the up has already been captured is worth of a debate.
Right. Okay.
But I think it will be for the year of 2012 an up year. I think the markets that tend to have higher dividend payouts will look pretty good this year. So I think that bodes well for example, Australia, New Zealand. I think the African markets have a good upside because they've been, you know, they've been beat up kind of with the global issues more so than they deserve. And so they're, I think, positioned to have some recoupment in place. You will find, I think, there'll be some European countries. You know, and Spain is one I'm looking at, thinking that Spain might surprise everybody because of this sort of diversity. You know, if you look at Greece, for example, where else is Greece in the world that could bolster Greece? There's nowhere.
Right.
You know,
right.
And Italy, you know, where else does Italy do business that's going to solve its problems in any great way? There really aren't many places, in my mind, they do. But Spain has this huge link with Latin America.
Absolutely.
And I think that it could surprise everybody about, and I'm talking from the financial market perspectives.
Correct.
It could surprise everybody, you know, as opposed to what's going on in Europe. It could be the positive surprise on this on the horizon for us. And then, you know, staid old England. You know, we've considered, you know, some of the government bonds, for example, the shorter term bonds may be a good alternative to the U.S. I think that England, while England is trying to get its act together, and while it's criticized for its austerity and other things, I think they're trying to figure out how they survive long term, and they may be doing that right now.
Great. Appreciate those insights. Well, I really appreciate your joining us. I'm sure our guests, our listeners do as well, for joining us. And I'm hoping you'll accept an invitation to come back again sometime so we can delve deeper into some of these topics now that we understand what you do and some of those markets and your global perspective. I'd love to dig in a little bit deeper, including in contrasting them to the U.S. market, because I worry about the U.S. market long term. So I'm hoping you will accept an invitation to join us again.
Delighted to. Thank you very much for...
All right. Well, thank you for the time, Robert, and enjoy your day and your travels coming up to Japan and India. And I don't envy the travel portion, but I'm sure your clients and investors are glad that you're out there, because I definitely wouldn't want to do it in order to invest in those markets. So thank you for the time, Robert. Appreciate that.
Thank you. Bye.
We've covered a number of aspects related to investing in our global village. We've heard that it is possible and maybe even profitable to invest in the far reaches of the world. There are no guarantees, but I can assure you of one thing, that if you don't invest, you won't have any income-generating assets, or IGAs as I affectionately call them. As I wrote in the few paragraphs announcing the show, investing in your own country will actually increase your risk. And risk is not always a good thing. For an investor based in the U.S. who invests only in U.S. stocks and bonds, that's like picking stocks and bonds only if they start with the letters A through N of the alphabet. Now, is there any logic to say that stocks with ticker symbols that start with an A or a B or a C will outperform those that start with an S or a T or a U? Of course not. And yet, doing that, a U.S.-based investor invests only in U.S. stocks will make an arbitrary choice to cut off a certain part of the market. The broader the geography, the asset classes and industry segments that you invest in, the lower your overall portfolio variability. And as you now know, variability is risk. So lower your variability, you lower your risk. I remind you of the third commandment of investing we covered last time, no risk, no reward. It does not say that we have to take more risk than we need to get that return. It just says that you sometimes have to venture out into markets like Asia or even Africa. They seem risky and yet will decrease the risk of your portfolio. We also talked about investing in those markets without local knowledge is not necessarily a risk you want to take. There are people like Robert Sherrar, our guest today, who travel there, analyze the companies, analyze the markets, and also allow you to invest, taking advantage of their many years of experience. And he definitely has experience in all those markets. And I have to remind you, there is another way to increase your return, lower your risk, and that's to tune into the show every 2 weeks. We'll challenge you, share great ideas, inspire you to be as wealthy as you want to be. The next Wealth DNA radio show is the fourth Monday of February, Monday, February 27th, 8 o'clock Arizona time, same place, same time. We're in the process of scheduling some great guests like Robert today, and as usual, your suggestions. Yes, you the listener, we want your suggestions, so feel free to send them to us. The archives of our past shows and the one you just listened to are on www.wealthdna.us. Now, if you've got questions, suggestions, guests you'd like us to invite, send an email to me, ron@wealthdna.us, and we'll keep you posted about future shows and events. By the way, the next show on the Boomer and the Babe Network is at 10 a.m., Survival with Jack Job. Happy investing in our global village.
You've been listening to Wealth DNA with the Ronald, Ron Naraki. Wealth DNA is a Boomer and the Babe Enterprises radio production. Contact them at boomerandthebabe.com.